Let's go to our first reading in Acts chapter 23. Please turn with me in your Bibles to Acts chapter 23. Verse 1, hear now the inerrant, infallible, and inspired Word of God. And Paul, earnestly beholding the council, said, "Men and brethren, I have lived in all good conscience before God until this day." And the high priest Ananias commanded them that stood by him to smite him on the mouth. Then said Paul unto him, "God shall smite thee, thou whited wall, for sittest thou to judge me after the law, and commandest me to be smitten contrary to the law?" And they that stood by said, "Revilest thou God's high priest?" Then said Paul, "I wist not, brethren, that he was the high priest, for it is written, thou shalt not speak evil of the ruler of thy people." But when Paul perceived that the one part were Sadducees and the other Pharisees, he cried out in the council, "Men and brethren, I am a Pharisee, the son of a Pharisee, of the hope and resurrection of the dead, I am called in question." And when he had so said, there arose a dissension between the Pharisees and the Sadducees, and the multitude was divided. For the Sadducees say that there is no resurrection, neither angel nor spirit, but the Pharisees confess both. And there arose a great cry, and the scribes that were of the Pharisees' part arose and strove, saying, "We find no evil in this man, but if a spirit or an angel has spoken to him, let us not fight against God." And when there arose a great dissension, the chief captain, fearing lest Paul should have been pulled in pieces of them, commanded the soldiers to go down and to take him by force from among them, and to bring him into the castle. And the night following, the Lord stood by him and said, "Be of good cheer, Paul, for as thou hast testified of me in Jerusalem, so must thou bear witness also at Rome." And when it was day, certain of the Jews banded together and bound themselves under a curse, saying that they would neither eat nor drink till they had killed Paul. And they were more than 40 which had made this conspiracy. And they came to the chief priests and elders and said, "We have bound ourselves under a great curse, that we will eat nothing until we have slain Paul. Now, therefore, ye with the council signify to the chief captain that he bring him down unto you tomorrow, as though ye would inquire something more perfectly concerning him. And we, or ever he come near, are ready to kill him." And when Paul's sister's son heard of their lying in wait, he went and entered into the castle and told Paul. Then Paul called one of the centurions unto him and said, "Bring this young man unto the chief captain, for he hath a certain thing to tell him." So he took him and brought him to the chief captain and said, "Paul the prisoner called me unto him and prayed me to bring this young man unto thee, who hath something to say unto thee." Then the chief captain took him by the hand and went with him aside privately and asked him, "What is that thou hast to tell me?" And he said, "The Jews have agreed to desire thee that thou wouldest bring down Paul tomorrow into the council, as though they would inquire somewhat of him more perfectly. But do not thou yield unto them, for there lie in wait for him of them more than 40 men, which have bound themselves with an oath that they will neither eat nor drink till they have killed him. And now are they ready, looking for a promise from thee." So the chief captain then let the young man depart and charged him, "See thou tell no man that thou hast showed these things to me." And he called unto him 2 centurions, saying, "Make ready 200 soldiers to go to Caesarea, and horsemen 70, and spearmen 200, at the third hour of the night, and provide them beasts that they may set Paul on and bring him safe unto Felix the governor." And he wrote a letter after this manner, "Claudius Lysias, unto the most excellent governor Felix sendeth greetings. This man was taken of the Jews and should have been killed of them. Then came I with an army and rescued him, having understood that he was a Roman. And when I would have known the cause wherefore they accused him, I brought him forth into their council, whom I perceived to be accused of questions of their law, but to have nothing laid to his charge worthy of death or bonds. And when it was told me how that the Jews laid wait for the man, I sent straightway to thee, and gave commandment to his accusers also to say before thee what they had against him. Farewell. Then the soldiers, as it was commanded them, took Paul and brought him by night to Antipatris. On the morrow they left the horsemen to go with him and returned to the castle, who, when they came to Caesarea and delivered the epistle to the governor, presented Paul also before him. And when the governor had read the letter, he asked of what province he was. And when he understood that he was of Cilicia, I will hear thee, said he, when thine accusers are also come. And he commanded him to be kept in Herod's judgment hall. May God add his blessing to the reading and to the hearing of his most holy word. All right, so I have the first section is verses 1 through 5. And notice we hear Paul very earnest in his defense. It says that he was earnestly beholding the council when he spoke to them. Paul is not playing games here. This is a part of his apostolic ministry, and he recognizes, and if we might import the feelings that Paul had for his own countrymen out of Romans chapters 9 and 10, we can understand how earnest he might have been. He loved his brothers and his what he calls his brethren according to the flesh, fellow Jews. He loved them, and so he desired to speak to them about the gospel. And so he had an opportunity then to speak to them. And for Paul, it was all earnestness here. And so he said, I have lived in good conscience before God and men. And then notice immediately upon having said that, the high priest gave a nod over to one of the temple guardsmen. And remember that there are two sets of soldiers there right now. There are the temple guardsmen, and then there are also the Roman soldiers. There are those who were with the chief captain, Claudius Lysias, and they were the ones who conducted Paul to this Jewish assembly. And then there were also there the Sanhedrin, the high priest, and the security forces that belonged to the Jews. Okay, so they're all there together. And Paul says, I've lived in good conscience before God and man until this day. And the high priest gives one of his security men a nod, and the man simply walks over to Paul and busts him one in the mouth. Boom. Just like that. Now, there are a lot of reasons why that could have taken place. It is perhaps that Paul had not yet been given leave to speak. It is perhaps that he did not acknowledge the high priest by simply addressing them as men and brethren. This Ananias here, this high priest, had a particular reputation of loving deference. He was a Sadducee, did not believe in any. It simply means that he was a materialist, scrupulous. With regard to the law, that's for sure, but also that they did not believe in any immaterial nature. So really, they were atheists. They were practical atheists, at least. Some of them might have had some nondescript confession of God, but they did not believe in angel or spirit. They were simple materialists. They were theological liberals who had an idea of God that is certainly not in keeping with the scriptures. And this is the high priest. And so he commands then that Paul be struck on the mouth. And so then Paul's response, and there's been much controversy over this response of the apostles here. He says, God shall smite thee, thou whited wall. What is a whited wall? Well, a whited wall is a wall that appears, it has an appearance of uprightness on the outside. But inside, if we could maybe import one of our own English phrases, as ugly as a mud fence. Right? And so this man is obviously corrupt on the inside, and yet he is whitened on the outside. And so Paul says, God shall smite thee, thou whited wall. And one of the men standing by says, dost thou revile God's high priest? And then Paul says, I wist not that he was the high priest, for it is written, thou shalt not speak evil of the ruler of thy people. Now, what does Paul mean there? Is Paul using extreme irony? Or is Paul really unaware that he was, or was he unaware that he was the high priest? I think the latter of those two is not tenable. I think Paul knew who he was. I think Paul is speaking with irony here. And I think most faithful commentators, I was reading Calvin on this just the other day, I think most faithful commentators would say something like this. What Paul means to say is, you have called him God's high priest. I recognize nothing of that in him. He doesn't believe in God, and he has commanded me to be smitten contrary to the law of God. And so I cannot recognize anything in him that corresponds to God's high priest. It is in that sense, I think, that Paul responded. And that Paul was a consummate one who understood and desired to keep the law. Notice he quotes the law back to them. Thou shalt not speak evil of a ruler of thy people. And yet, Paul has already said, I think, I see nothing in this man that would make him the ruler of our people. So, I think Paul's using irony there. And I would caution us, this is not a civil ruler. And so I think Paul is making a distinction between civil and ecclesiastical rulers here that sometimes does need to be made, right? Does a man need to be a Christian to rule rightly as a civil magistrate? The answer is no, he does not. Now, his rule will be sweetly enhanced by being a Christian, but its essence is not affected if he's not a Christian. Okay? Notice that a profligate high priest is really, quote unquote, no high priest. And it is in that sense, I think, that Paul is speaking here. Okay? All right, so we move on then to verses 6 through 11. Paul uses the divisive nature of the people to his advantage at this point. He knows that he will have a ready hearing with some of them, and perhaps he has a hope that they might be able to come to some kind of reasoned conversation with him when he speaks to them about the resurrection. He says he noted that one part were Sadducees and the other Pharisees, and he cried out in the council, men and brethren, I am a Pharisee, the son of a Pharisee, of the hope of the resurrection of the dead, I am called in question. Now, can I say, first of all, that what Paul said was absolutely true? Paul was a witness to the resurrection of Christ. That was, as we have seen already, part of the apostolic ministry. Remember in Acts chapter 1, Peter said, we need a 12th man, now that Judas has gone to his own place, we need a 12th man to witness with us concerning the resurrection. The apostolic ministry was a ministry that pertained to the resurrection of Christ. And so Paul is saying something that is indeed true here. Did he know that there would be an eruption in the assembly by him calling out such a confession as that? I don't know. The text doesn't say. It says that he perceived that some of them were Sadducees and some of them were Pharisees, which could be interpreted to mean he hoped to have a reasoned conversation about the resurrection. It is a possible interpretation that he had a reasonable expectation that they might also divide themselves. But even in that division, he would have had a hearing with some of them. And so they become raucous and unruly. And it says, Luke records here that they're about to tear Paul apart. And so notice the civil magistrate who is present at this council. What does he do? He comes in and he makes sure that everything is conducted according to the mind of God. That is, he protects the innocent from being torn apart. And that's what he's supposed to be doing. Right? And so this is one of those examples that our confession speaks of when it says that the civil magistrate can call a church council. Not only can he call a church council, but he can be present in it and assure that everything conducted therein is according to the mind of God. That is, according to the mind of God, according to his responsibility. He doesn't enter into a churchman's role, but he does keep the peace, which is exactly what this man did. And so they took Paul out of this council then, and they protected him, and they brought him back to a place of safety. All right, and then Paul receives the assurance from the Lord that what? That as you have testified in Jerusalem, you will also testify in Rome, so be of good cheer. They'll not tear you apart here. Okay? So that gets us through verse 11. And then 12 through 24, we have the plot of the 40 Jewish men. They enter into a curse. They bind themselves under a curse that they will neither eat nor drink until they had called Paul. Until they killed him. We assume that they broke that vow. But notice that men who will take a vow to kill someone, to murder someone, will probably have no trouble breaking a vow either. Right? It is unlawful for us to take vows to things that are unlawful. As a matter of fact, if we take a vow to something that we think is lawful, later we find out that it is unlawful, it is a sin for us to keep it. So let's remember that. But notice that these men had made this plot. They took this vow. They brought themselves under a great curse. We will eat nothing until we have slain Paul, verse 14 is how it reads there. And so they developed this plot. And notice that Paul's sister's son, this tells you that Paul was connected. These men have made this oath, this vow, and they've talked to the Jewish leadership, and it somehow leaks out of the Jewish leadership to Paul's sister's son, his nephew. And so if we remember that Paul was a Pharisee and sat at the feet of Gamaliel, he would have been very much in tune with the heartbeat of the Sanhedrin. And so then we have Paul's sister's son coming to Paul, telling him about the plot. And the other thing that I found interesting in this passage is the confidence that the Apostle Paul maintained before Claudius Lysias. There's a soldier attending Paul, which we would expect, seeing he is under arrest. But notice what happened here. He hears about this plot, and he calls the soldier over, and he says, take my nephew here to Claudius Lysias, to the chief captain, and he has something to tell him. That's all he has to say. Notice when the soldier comes to Claudius Lysias and says to him, Paul has sent this young man to thee so that he might tell you something, he might say, what? Do I receive private messages from prisoners on a regular basis? What are you talking about? But he doesn't do any of that. Actually, he takes the young man by the hand. That means he treats him gently, takes him aside to a private place, and hears the errand that he's on. So it tells you the confidence that the apostle maintained before his captors. They understood that he was a man of integrity, no matter what situation he was in. This reminds you something of Joseph, does it not? Who is put in charge of, well, just about everywhere he ends up. The prison, Potiphar's house, wherever it is. His skill, his grace, his uprightness, his honesty, all come to the fore. The same is true with the apostle. And so I might ask us all together, is it true of us? Right? Do we have that same kind of reputation that folks will indeed come to us, rely upon us? And when we say something, will they trust it to be true? All right, so the Lord has great care for His people then. Notice what Claudius Lysias does. Upon hearing of this, immediately he calls and he puts together a force of, over 300 men, armed with animals, writes a letter to the chief governor, Felix, and sends him down, protected, guarded, to Caesarea, to come under the auspices of Felix and get him out of that dangerous situation. I don't know about you all, but as we behold the actions of Claudius Lysias here, we see him as a man, may as well be an unbeliever, I don't know, but certainly a man commendable in his calling as a magistrate. He seems to be honest and upright. He recognizes his responsibility to care for and to keep safe those that are under his charge. And so there is a good example to be had there. All right, then so we move on to the end of the passage. That's 25 through 35. And we have the letter which Lysias sent to Felix. And if there is a criticism with regard to Claudius Lysias here, it might be in this letter. We might recognize a bit of embellishment here. And so while there is some embellishment here, there is also at least a germ of truth. Because I think what Claudius is doing is he might be conflating a couple of the things, right? Because there was the point at which Paul was on the stairs and he used the word Gentiles. And when he used the word Gentiles, then they arose into a furor, and he did rescue him at that point, but he was beating him. You remember that, right? Okay. What he says was, I recognize that they were about to tear him apart, and so I rescued him. Well, that was true perhaps of the second scenario. And so there's a little bit of conflation and a little bit of embellishment going on here. And so while we have used Claudius Lysias for a good example, let's also use him for a negative example as well. Let's not embellish, right? Let's leave the truth unvarnished. Let's not fudge or hedge in order to make ourselves appear better. Those kinds of things only serve our pride, right? Okay. All right, well, that ends the reading then of Acts chapter 23.